Thank you to our particularly well-dressed choir this morning. The reasons will be revealed later. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Thank you so much to every one of you for being here this morning. It's lovely to see you here. I invite you all to get in touch with your inner German and join me in singing the first hymn, hymn 291, Die Gedanken sind frei, proving that 3 years of high school German was not wasted on me.
Unitarian Universalist congregations begin our services by lighting a chalice, a symbol of our faith. Today, Paul Patterson will light our chalice. As the flame is lit, please join me in reading the chalice words printed in your order of worship. With the kindling of this flame, we affirm our commitment to accept life's gifts with grace and gratitude and use them to bless the world in the spirit of love. Good morning. My name is Jason Crow. I will be this morning's lay worship leader. Welcome to Wildflower Church, a Unitarian Universalist congregation. Unitarian Universalism is a liberal, free-thinking faith not requiring allegiance to any creed or doctrine for membership. We have chosen a heritage which places the final authority on matters of religion and philosophy, not with any church institution or book of scripture, but rather with the individual, based on their own conscience, reason, and lived experience. As Brian pointed out, the choir is dressed a little bit more somberly and coordinatedly today. The reason for this is to honor Leonard Cohen's philosophy that there's a crack in everything, and that's how the light gets through. I want to extend a special welcome to our first-time and returning visitors. If you'd like more information on membership in Wildflower, a greeter can assist you. We hope that everyone will join together after the service for coffee and conversation in the community room. It's that building to your left as you exit the sanctuary. In fact, let's get a head start on that right now. Let's all take about 60 seconds to say hello to the people near you, especially the people you don't know well. Will you please refer to your order of worship and join me in reading together Wildflower's Covenant of Right Relations. The Spirit in me welcomes the Spirit in you in all our wholeness and imperfection. We celebrate our connections and our differences. We care for one another and for ourselves. We listen to others with respect and open hearts, intending to understand. We speak to others with respect and kindness, intending to be understood. This beloved community is our spiritual home. We all share our gifts to build it. Thus do we commit to be in covenant and willing to be called back into covenant.
That was fun. I invite children of all ages, 1 through 99 or less or more, forward for the words for all ages. They're coming from all directions. Good morning to each of you. Hello. Do you want to get a little closer? Well, this story comes from the Jewish tradition. But it's many versions of it, so this is my version. And it's a story of this man and woman and 6 children who live in this tiny, tiny, tiny little house. And it's a kind of crowded, and the man and the woman are talking and thinking, you know, we just can't handle this. This is just too much. We don't have enough room. Let's go and talk to our rabbi. They were Jewish, and a rabbi is like a Jewish minister. And so they went to speak to the rabbi, and they said, you know, we've got no room in our house, and we just don't know what to do. We're at our wit's end. We're arguing, and we're fighting all the time. And they said, well, do you have a cat? And they went, well, we have a cat. And they went, oh, does it live inside or outside? They said, well, we don't know. It's a cat. It just shows up when it's hungry. Do you have any dogs? And he said, yes. Where do they live? Well, it lives outside. He said, well, bring the dog in and let's see if that helps your living. So they went back home, they allowed the dog inside, and eventually, you know, everything became chaotic. Because not only were there six children and the man and the woman, guess what? The dog would chew on things. You know, I've got a dog, and my daughter's selling Girl Scout cookies, and it got into a packet of Girl Scout cookies the other day and ate the whole packet. Which is not good. So this dog basically was eating everything in the house. He would grab food off the table. And so he said, we need to go and talk to the rabbi again. So they went back to the rabbi and said, well, things are worse. Thanks for your advice. Now we've got this dog in there. He goes, do you have any chickens? He said, yes, we've got chickens. Why don't you bring them into the house as well? He said, really, you want us to bring the chicken in the house? And he said, yes. I said, okay. So they went home and they brought the chickens in the house. Guess what happened?
They pecked at all the stuff. Exactly,
and they pecked at the staff, and they would wander around, and you'd trip over them, and there was just absolute chaos. So they thought, oh, it's even worse. We need to go and talk to this rabbi. So they went back a week later, talked to the rabbi, and said, you know, we brought the dog in, it got worse. We brought the chickens in, it's even worse now. Oh, that's okay. You're always welcome, even if you're late. So the chickens come, you know, so he said, the chickens come in and it's even worse now. So I thought, what do we do? Do you have a goat? And the couple kind of looks at them and kind of fearfully and says, yes, we've got a goat. And he says, well, why don't you bring the goat into the house? I said, look, we've brought the dog into the house. We brought the chickens in the house. Now you're asking us to bring the goat into the house. So they brought the goat into the house. Do you know what goats do when human beings bend over? They butt you, yes. And so this goat would butt them. So when one of them was trying to get into a cupboard, they would bend over and the goat would run in and butt them. The goats eat everything. They chew everything. And so they eat everything. And so things are absolutely disastrous. Things are falling apart. Everyone's arguing. No one's happy. So they thought, let's go back to the rabbi one final time. So they go back to the rabbi one final time and said, okay, we've done everything you said. Things are worse than ever. And he went, do you have a cow? And he said, okay, we've got a cow. Yes, we've got a cow. Bring that into the house. And he said, you've got to be kidding. We're already in chaos. We have no room. That was the problem to start off. And he said, bring the cow into the house and make room for it. So they go in and they're like, well, we've got absolutely no room. So he said, well, let's start tidying up and moving things around and trying to create space and get rid of the stuff we don't need. And they finally were able to squeeze the cow into the house, but no one could really move. I thought, this is even worse. They're going to go back and talk to the rabbi. So they went back to talk to the rabbi and said, you know, things are absolutely worse. We can't even move in the house. Things are getting eaten. We can't even eat our own food because some of the animals get it before we get to the table. He says, why don't you let all the animals back outside? He thought, well, we can definitely do that. So they went home and they left all the animals outside. And they realized that since they had tidied up their house and they'd got rid of stuff, they actually had plenty of room for the man, the woman, and the six children. And they got really happy. So they went back to the rabbi again, and they went angry this time and said, thank you for your advice. You actually helped us create some space in our life and really appreciate what we have. So thank you very much. So thank you so much for listening. It was lovely to have you all. And please, if you could walk to your religious education class. And thank you all for being here. Even if you're late, Rufus, it's okay.
Good morning. I have a quick announcement about the survey, and hopefully you're not getting tired of hearing me say this, but we're in the last week, and we have so far 50 responses, so we're about two-thirds of the way to the goal of 75. Remember that the reward at the end of that is a dessert party on February 11th. So if you haven't filled it out, please go out and fill that out. We do have the link on the website. It was also in the email. And for those of you that are like me and like things old school, there's paper copies out in the membership table as well. Thank you.
Okay, I said I'd be quick with this one. If you are one of the people that could be free Monday morning, and if you're willing, come down to City Council and help push them to push Austin Energy to buy the next 450 megawatts of solar power. This is how we stop global warming, one city at a time. And if you can, I have a handout for you. I'll be by the door. Look for the stampeding horses.
Good morning. I'm Erin Walter. I'm the intern minister at Wildflower. And there is so much going on here. I hope you're looking at your order of service for the many things that you are all invited to. Even if you are visiting for the first time, you are welcome. One of those things is today at 1:30 in the community room, after we all spend time visiting, there will be a spiritual growth workshop, which I'm leading, and we've done it before, and it leads to wonderful things because you get together and we talk about what do we think spirituality is anyway? What do we think we could be doing to be living full and rich and beautiful lives, especially sustaining ourselves in resistance in times like these? So this is where the Buddhism group grew from. This is where the deep sharing group grew from. And we'll talk about what sustains us, and we'll get to know each other. So that's 1:30 to 3:30 in the community room. Just stay after coffee hour. And there is childcare. Parents, I know we need spiritual practices as much or more than anyone. Thank you so much, and I hope to see you.
I've got one quick announcement as well. On February 15th, it's a Wednesday, the Texas Unitarian Universalist Justice Ministry are having their legislative day. This is where we go and meet our state representatives and their staff to promote issues that are important to us at the Texas State Legislature. There's three main issues we've got. We're talking about immigration, refugee justice, income inequality and economic justice, and reproductive justice. I have got sheets here that will be in the fellowship hall afterwards, but it's Wednesday the 15th of February. All are welcome, and Unitarian Universalists from all over Texas are going to be there, including myself. Please come and talk to me about it. There will be email this week with more information. On the subject of refugee justice, immigration justice, has been a lot in the news, and in that spirit, before the prayer, I'd like to read a poem called The Red Brocade by the Palestinian-American poet Naomi Shebab Nye. The Arabs used to say, when a stranger appears at your door, feed him for 3 days before asking who he is, where he'd come from, and where he's headed. That way he'll have strength enough to answer. Or by then you'll be such good friends you don't care. Let's go back to that. Rice, pine nuts. Here, take the red brocade pillow. My child will serve water to your horse. No, I was not busy when you came. I was not even preparing to be busy. That's the armor everyone puts on to pretend they have a purpose in the world. I refuse to be claimed. Your plate is waiting. We will snip fresh mint into your tea. Those are the words of Naomi Shebab Nye. And with the recent immigration fiasco, those words seem more important than ever. I invite you to join me in the spirit of prayer and meditation and reflection.
Spirit of life, your very presence amongst us is what gives us connection. At this time, help us to sense that beneath our feet is the strength we need to keep grounded. Help us to feel that behind our back is the protection we need to feel safe facing our fears. Help us to know that before our eyes lies the beauty we seek to feel astounded. Help us to lift our heads high enough to be aware of the vastness of the sky and our spirit. And help us to know that within our hearts lies the love we need to complete the circle of connection in each of our lives. We are grateful, Spirit of Love, for this day and for the connections we have. May we use all of these gifts, our feet, our backs, our eyes, our heads, and our hearts to bring love to this hurting world. This world which we so value and which we cherish. I invite you to join me in silence. Blessed be and amen. Please remain seated and join me in singing hymn number 8 in the blue hymnal, Mother Spirit, Father Spirit.
So the subject of transcendentalism is deep water, quite a bit out of my depth, actually. But I do know something about deep water. I know that I am terrified of it. Here's your $10 word for the day, thalassophobia. Thalassophobia. It means an irrational fear of the sea or other bodies of water, and it applies to me. Just looking at a greenish body of water and the eerie things beneath its surface gives me the same physical, visceral feeling that most people experience when an elevator starts moving down, or when they look over the edge of a tall building, or when their airplane touches down. Video footage of divers exploring shipwrecks is more terrifying to me than any Hollywood horror movie. It's completely irrational, and I cannot explain it. I never saw the movie Jaws as a kid. That's not it. It's just something instinctual and permanent about me. As a 40-year resident of Austin, Texas, I've made many a pilgrimage to the sacred waters of Barton Springs, where motorcyclists get VIP parking every day. The Barton Springs Diving Board is perhaps the cheapest fun I know how to have in the rather expensive city of Austin. Now, I have absolutely no skill at diving, but of all the show-offs at the pool showing off their diving board tricks that day, I can bounce higher than any of them. I'm as goofy and graceless as a goat in the air, but I can bounce high enough to get applause. Let me tell you, standing on that diving board and committing to entering the water is a transcendent effort of will every single time for me. For there, in those holiest of waters, lurks the Leviathan, the sea monster of Hebrew legend, the Tiamat of Mesopotamian legend, the Cthulhu of H.P. Lovecraft. A mythical beast of unimaginable monstrosity and chaotic cruelty, and it's going to get me. My rational mind knows perfectly well that there's nothing down there in that water that's going to get me. The rest of me doesn't care. I know perfectly well that worst case scenario, perhaps a crawfish might pinch my big toe, or an endangered toothless salamander might decide to see if I taste good. I know all that, but that knowledge doesn't even make a dent in my irrational fear standing upon the diving board. But down there in that freezing cold water, down below the diving board, just to the right of the Leviathan, there is something very special, something that I wish everyone could experience. So I pluck up all my courage, bounce high into the air, take a deep breath, and dive the 15 feet down to the bottom of the pool, where there's a hole in the rock wall, where the spring water comes rushing out, thousands and thousands of gallons per hour of very cold, very old water. I can't say that it's technically the coldest or the purest water in Austin, but it sure feels that way. I dive down, put my head directly into that forceful blast of ancient dihydrogen monoxide, take a firm hold of the rock wall, and try to hold on as long as my breath will allow. And then I stomp my feet against the sandy bottom as hard as I can and burst to the surface. It is a transcendent experience. You want to know what else I'm scared of? Public speaking. In fact, I'm not even here right now. I'm at the bottom of Barton Springs where it's safer. I'll take the Leviathan any day, thank you very much. And I'd like to thank the diving board for helping me to prepare for this transcendent moment. I don't think that overcoming fears was really the intended focus of the transcendentalist writers, but I did warn you at the beginning of this service that this is a liberal and free-thinking movement. I came to Wildflower just for the music, and I stayed because it pushes me out of my comfort zone and into growth. Blessed be.
There's many statements about money, and one is that money doesn't make the world go around, but it sure makes a journey a lot more fun. And the other is that money can't buy you happiness, but that just means you're not spending it properly. So we are going to give you a chance to spend your money properly. The morning offering is how we support this church. We support this church financially through the gifts of our members and guests, and that is how we sustain ourselves. We get no outside funding. And community, especially a respectful, open-minded, liberal community, does have its price, and we are sustained through the generosity of all the people who have given to Wildflower their time, their talents, and yes, their money. For those of you visiting for the first time, please let the plate pass. Your presence here is gift enough. The morning offering will now be given and gratefully received. This morning's reading comes from The Oversoul by 19th century Unitarian minister, essayist and leader in the Transcendentalist movement, Ralph Waldo Emerson. Let us learn the revelation of all nature and thought, that the highest dwells within us, that the sources of nature are in our own minds. As there is no screen or ceiling between our heads and the infinite heavens, so there is no bar or wall in the soul where we, the effect, cease, and God, the cause, begins. I am constrained every moment to acknowledge a higher origin for events than the will I call mine. There is a deep power in which we exist and whose bliss is accessible to us. Every moment when the individual feels invaded by it is memorable. It comes to the lowly and simple. It comes to whosoever will put off what is foreign and proud. It comes as insight. It comes as serenity and grandeur. The soul's health consists in the fullness of its reception. Forever and ever, the influx of this better and more universal self is new and unsearchable. Within us is the soul of the whole, the wise silence, the universal beauty to which every part and particle is equally related, the eternal one. When it breaks through our intellect, it is genius. When it breathes through our will, it is virtue. When it flows through our affections, it's love. Those are the words of Ralph Waldo Emerson.
That song always reminds me of an experience I had at my previous church. My music director came to me and said, I've got this song I'd really like to do, but I'm not sure of the lyrics. I said, what song is it? And he goes, oh, it's Hallelujah by Leonard Cohen. I said, oh, what about the lyrics bother you? And, you know, there's a passage where David is lusting after the woman in the rooftop. And he was just worried about the sexual innuendo in some of the lines. And I'm going, that comes from the Hebrew scriptures. I think it's okay for it to be in church. But there's an interesting element to two of the verses here. And you're going to think I'm really stretching this connection. But two of the verses about David are talking about how abuse of power in the name of lust can be problematic. Abuse of power. It's been an interesting week, this last week, with some of the executive orders, not least of which was the one around immigration, where it was actually barring legal immigrants. This is not even anything about undocumented immigrants. This is about legal immigrants not being allowed in because of the country they come from. So I think that Hallelujah song from referring to a story from 2,700 years ago to this day can relate. It's where people abuse their power to prevent others living fully. So what I really want to do is talk about justice today. I want to talk about justice, particularly in the concept of the transcendentalists. And most of us who know of transcendentalists, and I'm with Jason in this, I studied it and I still don't really get it. That may worry you right now since you're about to listen to me. But one of the things, transcendentalists, as we interpret it now, often emphasize this individualism. You know, and I think the United States history over the last 200 years has been this more and more radical individualism and less concern for community. And some people put transcendentalists, but especially the transcendentalist literature, at the center of that, because that was almost the first homegrown American art and literature. And it really emphasized the individualism. And that is true to a degree, but it misses some of the important religious points of transcendentalism. Now, one of the figures who I read from earlier, Ralph Waldo Emerson, I think he knew about transcendentalism since he was considered one of the leaders of it. And he emphasized this individualism quite strongly. And even that passage he talked about, the divine, the God, the sacred, could be best accessed through the human mind and the human soul. In fact, the reading that I gave you was about the transcendentalist perspective on the human soul. And he felt that was where the divine could be best accessed. And he was kind of critical at the time. You have to realize he was writing this in 1838. So this was right around the time post-Enlightenment where they realized that there was a lot of research into the Bible going, this probably didn't happen. There was a lot of, you know, literary criticism of the Bible, and science was starting to critique some of the miracles. And geologists had just discovered, at that time they thought the Earth was millions of years old. But up until that point, people thought the Earth was 6,000 years old, because that's what the Bible said, at least in the Western countries. And then these geologists started realizing, they thought, no, it's at least millions of years old. And then consequently, we now know it's billions of years old. But so all of this was starting to question some of the truth of the Bible, because even within the Unitarian movement at the time, the Bible was considered to be literally true, and it was considered to be a sacred work because of the miracles in it. And Ralph Waldo Emerson just questioned that. He said, the supernatural element of God does not make sense. So he brought that and he said, the best access to religion is through our imagination, not through our reason, which was one of the thrusts of early Unitarianism. It was through our imagination. He came from the romantic side. He lived in the world of ideals and big ideals. But liberal Christianity, and I include Unitarian at that time, still took reason, tradition, and biblical scholarship as its foundations. But transcendentalism made that personal experience, that personal exploration, that exploration of the soul, that exploration of the spirit, that was what was most vital. And you can see how that origin back in the 1830s still exists within our Unitarian Universalist movement today. Most of us question elements of the supernatural God, if not just deny it. Most of us see our own personal exploration, as when Jason introduced about what Unitarian Universalism was about. We say that the final truth and meaning for religion lies with the individual. So you can see how the early transcendentalists had a huge impact in our movement. But while he questioned the supernatural, he really felt that it wasn't really worth a human being's time to get involved in justice issues. He even thought slavery was too small an issue for him to get involved with. So here's this supreme intellectual man. He definitely was one of the smarter people in the 19th century, but he didn't think of getting engaged in justice issues was important. He felt everything was in this personal exploration. His actual words regarding abolition was, "Transcendentalists should not labor for small objects such as abolition." Living in that time, it's hard to see how people could ignore the issue of slavery. And of course, you couldn't. It ended up with the Civil War in 1860. But one of the other great transcendentalists came from a very different background. Ralph Waldo Emerson came from a very privileged background. He was educated at Harvard, which was a Unitarian theological school. Margaret Fuller is an incredible person. Her father, she came from a relatively well-off background too. Her father was a member of the Congress, and he wanted her educated, but he didn't show a lot of love. One of his letters to Margaret Fuller, or to Margaret Fuller's mother, says, when Margaret was four, said that, "Tell Margaret I love her if she learns French." There's a slight lack of compassion there. But he did provide her with a lot of education. And she was phenomenal. She was a genius. And she wanted to go to Harvard College, but at that time, it would only allow men to serve. But eventually, Margaret Fuller realized that there were so many opportunities were close to her. She was born in 1810, so she was a contemporary of Ralph Waldo Emerson. Even though she wasn't given the formal education opportunities, she was able to educate herself. And she started these clubs for women where they would talk about religion, theology, politics, issues of the day, ethics. And they would have the book groups where they would read the books used at Harvard Divinity School. Because they weren't allowed to go to school, but she could study it. And she'd have groups of 35, 40 women, including some people like Elizabeth Cady Stanton, would be part of that group. And so she started these groups, but she realized that she had to get involved in justice because she was thwarted as a human being and as a woman because of her gender. And so she saw this strong thirst of social justice, not in a radical sense of social engagement and non-violent resistance, but on the grounds of building community, educating women, opening doors for women which weren't open to them. And she wrote the first book to really critique called Women's in the 19th Century, the first American exploration of women's life. And she talked about constructed gender identities in the 1830s. This is issues we're still working with. This is issues that we really started studying formally in college in the 1970s, really. And she had proposed this back in the 1830s. And here's a quote from her from that book. She says, "We would have every arbitrary barrier thrown down. We would have every path laid open to women as freely as to man. Were this done and a slight temporary fermentation allowed to subside, we would see the crystallizations more pure and of more various beauty. We believe the divine energy would pervade nature to a degree unknown in the history of former ages, and that no discordant collision, but a ravishing harmony of the spheres would ensure. Yet then, and only then, will mankind be ripe for this, when inward and outward freedom for woman as much as man shall be acknowledged as a right, not yielded as a concession. Then and only then will mankind be ripe for this, when inward and outward freedom for woman and as much as for man shall be acknowledged as a right and not yielded as a concession. And Margaret Fuller suffered resistance along this path. She married late in life, had a child at 38 at that time, which was not only dangerous, it was very unusual. And she actually went to Europe because she got so much opposition in the United States and got involved in the Italian Revolution and became a committed socialist in the 1840s. But one of the things Margaret Fuller points to us to, that when our own identities are thwarted, then we often get engaged in justice. She died at the age of 40 in a shipwreck when she was coming home. And the letter she wrote before she came almost prophesied her death. Her child and her husband died at the same time. And I want to explore her more fully in another service because she is a rich, rich person. And the third person who's considered a leader in the Transcendentalist movement, he was an absolute radical. He was Theodore Parker. And while Emerson questioned the supernatural element of God, in a sermon that Theodore Parker gave that was resisted by most Unitarians called The Transient and Permanent in Christianity, he really saw stuff like Jesus, the Bible, as very temporary. He did not see that as something that was lasting. It was not a lasting religious value. So he really emphasized that. And for 30 years, he was not allowed in another Unitarian pulpit. But he became very committed through, he came up in a very poor background. He became very committed to the causes of women's suffrage and slavery. But he was not passive in any way. He was involved in the Underground Railroad. And what happened in the 1850s, which radicalized a lot of the Unitarian movement, was the Fugitive Slavery Act. And what that said was that the North could basically ignore slavery and just benefit financially. But what the Fugitive Slavery Act, and this was brought in to keep the South and the North together, what this Fugitive Slavery Act did was it asked for anyone in the North who found a runaway slave, by law, they had to hand him in to the authorities so he could be returned to his owner. And Theodore Parker totally resisted that. He ran the Underground Railroad, and there's stories of him writing sermons with the Bible in one hand and a loaded pistol at his desk in case anyone came. And he actually married two runaway slaves at one point. And just during the wedding ceremony, he conducted the wedding ceremony with a Bible in one hand and a loaded pistol. The pistol was not to make the man marry the woman. It was not a shotgun wedding. It was to resist anyone who came for those slaves. And he was extreme. He funded John Brown's raid. He was one of the six financiers of John Brown's raid at Harper's Ferry. He saw slavery as an abomination, and he wanted to overturn it. So you see these three people who were all transcendentalists, who had very different approaches for justice. One was kind of passive. One was built groups, community groups to work, and then one who put their body and life on the line for justice. And it was all grounded in their inner beliefs. They saw that what was happening in the world did not make sense to what was innate within them. And I think that's where passionate justice comes from. And I look at what my inner beliefs are, and this executive order about immigration hurts me badly. I am an immigrant, in case you didn't notice. And I've been through that process, and I came in as a native English speaker with a company sponsoring me, an American company sponsoring me, I was college educated. I came through that process as privileged as you could come through, and it was horrible. It was dehumanizing. And let me tell you a couple of stories to show you. When I was, the day I was to get to my green card, I lived in San Diego, but I was up in Orange County. And I had to go in to get my green card, and I met my lawyer there. And there was a room that was about a third of the size of this with 200 people in it. No sitting room at all standing, waiting to go through. So we were there, and there was a coffee on top of this trash can. And these were people who were getting decisions made whether they could stay in the country, whether families would be together. This was not waiting for your driver's license. One of the workers came out, moved the trash can, a big cup of coffee fell and spilled. She goes, "Who brought that in? Who brought that in? No one's going to get served until the person who brought that in owns up." This is people waiting for their life's decisions to get made. Then eventually we got in, she walked away, no one admitted to it. And I went into the final interview, and the person can be best described as rude. No humour, almost no eye contact, nothing. And I was sitting there, and she looked and said, "Is that your phone number there?" And I said, "Yes, it is." And she called it. And it rang 4 or 5 times, and I was not quite as discreet back then as a young man as I am now. And I said, "I don't think I'm home." She looked at me, and she slammed the phone down. My lawyer glared at me as well. So I was a little quieter after that. And then there was, but you realize you are so powerless as an immigrant. You have no rights, really, in this country. And one time when I was coming in through LA, this young man who was checking me in, I was coming in, I had a job here, I was here legally, whatever that means. And I came in, and he looked at me and said, "Are you a communist?" And I said, "No. I've had left-wing leanings, you may be surprised to hear, over the years, but not a communist." And there was a dynamic there that I think is important. The guy was looking at me. He was about early 20s. I was mid-20s. And there was a rather attractive young lady about his age, waiting in line, so he could hear all this, and I think that's important to the story. And he said, "Well, was your mum and mother or father a communist?" I said, "No, they weren't." "Was your grandfather a communist?" And he was. So I'm not sure how they knew. Did he know that? Was he guessing? Was he playing? But my grandfather was a coal miner. And in Britain, life was hard for someone in the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s as a coal miner. And there was two sides to British communism. It was either the intellects or the working class. And he said, my dad, this is my mum's father, but my dad once said, "I'd like to go to a meeting of the Communist Party with you." And he said, "Don't do it," he says, "because they watch who goes in and out and keep track." My dad told me that story, and I worry now, is there something on my record about my grandfather being a communist? Because that was a very random question to get asked me on immigration, but I could have realised he could have prevented me coming in. And there was other questions you get asked in the immigration forms about, have you ever prosecuted anyone on behalf of the Nazi Party from 1933 to 1945? It felt like it was okay to persecute someone for other reasons or outside those time frames. You know, it was really strange. And then I also got asked, was I a professional vagrant? To which I replied, I didn't know that was a profession. So you get these bizarre questions, but the whole point with the phone call and the coffee, and it was dehumanising and an incredibly important element. You're talking about families getting separated. You're talking about, you know, lives getting changed. Some people going back to really dangerous places, like a friend of mine who had no status, who was from Iraq. This was in the 1980s when Saddam Hussein in power, and he talked about he would die if he went back to Iraq, and I believe him. So these decisions for me was kind of inconvenient, despite being annoying. For other people, it was literally a matter of life and death. And I think that's what's happening now with these latest immigration orders, because each of the countries that these people are not being allowed into and not being allowed in from are dangerous places for those people. And I'll finish with a final story about immigration. That when I was working as a chaplain, and this wasn't me, but I was working as a chaplain, I was gotten called to Dell's Children's Hospital up here. And it was a mother with a one-day-old baby that was really struggling. And I met the woman, and she was from Mexico. She was here with documentation, but her husband was undocumented, and he'd been extradited 4 days before the birth of his own child. And the baby was not doing well. And when, you know, talking through the translator for a time, I spent 4 hours with her, but the translator had to leave. The baby's heart, there was a problem, like it was in the wrong way. So we sat and we prayed and we talked. She told me about her husband who had been, extradited. And I just thought of the whole inhumanity of that. Here's a family, a person here's illegally, with a young baby. Did they have to extradite him 4 days before, and then they have this tragedy? There's a dehumanizing aspect to this immigration system that needs to be changed. There's a dehumanizing aspect to how we treat refugees. There's a dehumanizing aspect that I'm seeing a lot in the conduct of this current administration, with no respect for those who are different from what is perceived as mainstream. And I think we need to resist. And when I look at how I want to resist, it's not how Ralph Waldo Emerson. I'm going in there to get strength and courage. I need to do that. But I'm not going to stay there. I'm going to go out like Margaret Fuller and build communities like this so that we can engage and build power for it to be more, bring more justice. Amen. But I'm going to go out there, and I am willing, like, not, I'm not taking a gun to a wedding or to worship, but I'm going to be willing to put my body between those who are oppressing and those who are oppressed, because I think that's what needs to happen. We need a radical form of justice. We need to look inside ourselves to say, what can we do? And we can't be passive about it. And I know some of us here have, struggle identities that are targeted by this. So I think each of us, I think everyone needs to be involved. I don't think anyone can step back and not be involved from this movement, because I think there's some really, really dangerous things. There's people who are threatened, there's people who are scared, there's people who are anxious. And I think more of us, like myself, who have privilege, need to put our bodies on the line. So will you bail me out when I get arrested? That's the answer I wanted. But it's a time, this time calls for radical action. But we need to ground that in a rich spirituality. We can't sustain this by just going off to do one event. We need to ground it in our own values. And when there's something that triggers us, be it the latest news article through an incident, we need to pause and look inside ourselves and take 5 seconds, 10 seconds to analyze what's really going on inside of us. Because our bodies are carrying a lot of struggles. There's a wonderful book about trauma, and I'll be leading worship in trauma in March, called The Body Keeps the Score. I thoroughly recommend it. The Body Keeps the Score. Because I think right now I'm hearing from a lot of people that they are being triggered by a lot of what's happening. And some people are being physically threatened and assaulted. And we did a collection last week for the Islamic Center of Lake Travis. You probably heard another Islamic center was burnt down elsewhere in the States. We need to get engaged. And I believe we need to follow the example of people like Theodore Parker, who was willing to take a radical stance on justice. And we need to ground that in the rich spirituality, and that's where transcendentalism is best, not as an individualistic sense, but realizing it's a spiritual creature, as a person with the image of God in me, I also see the image of God in each of us. And that image of God is what connects us and what calls me to be my brother's and sister's keeper.
Our benediction word comes from Theodore Parker. We have a religion which, like sunshine, goes everywhere, is temple of space, its shrine the good heart, its creed of good, its ritual works of love, its profession of faith, divine living. So let us go out there and let us transform ourselves to ourselves for meaning, finding the strength we can engage the world. A world that needs us to heal, and let us transform the world with acts of love. Go in love.